It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Yeah, we're not afraid here and Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day in the afternoon. The times have changed because Arizona doesn't change. Daylight savings, you guys all changed now. It's all messed up for me. We're different because, you know, we stay the same, stay the same, stay the same. We will not change. We want our time to be the same. But that means sometimes we're on Pacific, sometimes we're on Mountain. Well, now we're on Mountain, I think. So we're getting it all organized. We have today on the air, we got our times all set up. He's coming on, is Edward Griffin. Now, Griffin is the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, and I'm sure a lot of the people in this audience already gets it. Yeah, they created it. They did it because they could, and it benefits them. And I'll tell you where I want to go. Now what? Because now it's gotten, you know, in a short period of a year and a half, 2 years with Dr. Paul's campaign, all of a sudden, boom, you got 18-year-olds understand. So now what do we do? You know, what are we going to do? We are in a situation now to where we have we're relatively concerned. What we're concerned about is that they know that we want to get out of this thing. And they're not going to let us. Dr. Paul's bill has made it through all kinds of machinations through the House and the Senate, and then they just come up with something else. So what do we do? They're expecting us not to do anything. They're expecting us to be afeared of our H1N1. Man, you need more shots. Now, we can go on and on about that, but I'm telling you, the thing is that the people have to have confidence in the fact that they can have an effect. Or they can't. What is going to be the message? What is going to be the message? You know, the message is either we can or we cannot use the system. Can we? I am of the opinion that the worst thing we could have done during the Ron Paul Revolution was to give a false hope. And that was a discussion that we had before we even tried to do it. A lot of the people that had the time and money that was willing to get behind this thing. And we were of the mind that the net benefit that would come out of it would be that there would be more people that understand what's going on. There would be more people that realize what was happening, that got an education. That would start from a base understanding in real time that happened to them. An entire generation that understood what was going on. Has it worked out for us? Well, I tell you, we have a continuing education. Because they converted the revolution, tried to collectivize it, and put it into the campaign for liberty. You know, power to the people, man. Go forth, learn, play inside, call, make all your phone calls. We helped. We've done everything that we can. And the situation is this. We are in a situation to where we have an opportunity to have, for the first time in modern history, the ability to free ourselves of central banking and central planners through the banking system. Because the dollar is going to implode. I know this. This is not a secret. They know it. Chinese sure as heck know it. European investors in our debt know it. The math is not, you physically cannot pay off this debt. It is impossible. Unless you inflate. you know, then the value of whatever people that gave us the money to begin with is, you know, nothing anyway. So what we're going to do is I'm going to go ahead and try and make sure that you're protected from what's coming, because it's a detonation that's already happened. As you sit here in Arizona, it's you can see for, you know, you get up high and you can see hundreds of miles. I mean, it's just it's amazing. There has been a mushroom cloud forming in the distance. It's already happened. You saw the flash. See the mushroom cloud going up. It's beautiful. Shockwave hasn't hit yet. But you can't unexplode the bomb. It's already gone. Mr. Griffin, I got you there?
Yes, you do indeed.
You know, I'm so glad that you're on, and I'll tell you one thing. You know, I'm going to give you, I did a little bit of introduction for you. I'm going to allow you a few moments to introduce yourself and so on, and, of course, what your expertise is. But I'm telling you, the reason I wanted to have you on is I wanted to talk about now what. I mean, it's a now what. So go, please introduce yourself to the audience for me, would you please?
Well, Ernie, that's kind of hard to do because I don't know what interests people. I guess the best way to introduce myself is to say that I've written a couple of books that have been popular, and probably the one that's of most interest to your audience is called The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. I've written other books that I think are very interesting, on one on cancer, which, of course, is very important to most people today. But I think your topic is the monetary crisis, the meltdown, what happens now.
And, of course, I do want to get into that. But there was another thing that kind of surprised me. Years ago in 2004, I was running for U.S. Senate against McCain. So that, you know, had a lot of interest. And I made sure that wherever I went, I had at least 50 to 100 bootleg copies of Black Box Voting.
Oh, yes.
And what was interesting to me was you were a producer of that, or certainly had a hand in making sure it was made. And I always wanted to ask you, what up with that? How did you get involved in that one?
Well, that's a good question, too. It sort of crept up on me, Ernie. I was not aware that there was such a blatant fraud in the voting machine business, until all of a sudden a fellow just pointed it out to me. He said, are you aware that, you know, these companies are building machines that are deliberately been crafted so that they could throw elections? And I remember my thought at the time, well, they would never dare do that, would they? And, of course, it didn't take him very long to point out to me that, yes, they would dare do it. And, of course, with my I was already up to speed in that I knew that there are plenty of people out there who would want to do that and had motives for capturing control of the American people while letting them think that they were participating in their own political destiny. And I knew that part, and so the pieces went together very quickly. And I became kind of electrified, and I said, well, let's do something about this right away. So that's how it got started. I was most of the issues that are out there on the scene, I can honestly say that I've gradually become aware of them from their inception, but that's one that really came up from behind and hit me on the back of the head.
Well, you know, I got involved, it was 88, you know, I'm a young man starting to see, you know, what's what, and there was a thing called the Omnibus Trade Competitiveness Act of 88 that Daddy Bush did when he got in, and it was all about how they controlled commerce internationally. Anything that was exported or imported in the United States, they got their cut. And when I read that, I saw the New World Order in print, man. I never even heard the term. I'm a 20-something-year-old kid. I didn't know any different. But I read this, and I go, oh, this is not the government they were talking about in junior high. This is not it. And you find a thread, and you pull on it, and all of a sudden, all this stuff starts to come unraveled, and then you come in contact with other people that have their own understanding from a different perspective, and, of course, your book would always come up. And you may not remember, but years ago I've had you on the air before. We've had you on with Charles Goyette when I was producer there. We've had, you know, and followed this. And now for the first time in human history, we have an understanding by a whole younger generation that just how manipulated they are and their future with this central banking. Now, I think that we can go one step further. Instead of now, especially with the audience that listens to this show and a lot of the people go to Freedom's Phoenix and the young people that we work with here at a Freedom's Phoenix workshop, is that they get it. Now, we understand. And I want to add something to the mix. I want to get from your perspective, now what? These guys, you know, in just the last few days, they've done their best to gut Dr. Paul's legislation. They are not going to allow an audit. They are not going to allow a look into the books to where they took billions, if not trillions of dollars, and sent it overseas. They're not going to allow that to happen. What is going to be the end result? Now, of course, with the music, that means we got to wait on pens and needles to come back to Ed Griffin and have him tell us from his perspective and all these things, from looking at election fraud. You know, is that, are we going to become free by voting our freedom in? Is that possible? I don't know. And if they won't let us look at the books, then what? We'll talk about more when we come back on Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock, and Mr. Griffin, just a little bit.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Yeah, we're back here in Phoenix, Arizona. Declare your independence. Me, Ernest Hancock, and Edward Griffin. You know, Edward, I wanted to make sure that we got, you know, your perspective on this because, I mean, I know you've been paying attention, and I'm not sure if you ever thought we'd, you know, in your lifetime get to this point that we are right now to where we are on the precipice of being able to at least understand that the Federal Reserve needs to get gone. But they're going to try and bring us in. They're going to skip this Amaro thing, go straight to the world, though. And are they going to get away with it? Should we allow them? Should we just, you know, do the Galt's Gulch deal? Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged, and just, you know, set down our plows and say, you know what, we're not playing anymore. We'll just go over here for a little while. Should there be actual resistance? You know, in your mind, what should happen, and what do you think is likely to happen?
Oh, boy, what a big playing field that is.
Yeah, I'll keep you going for at least 10 minutes.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Well, I have to say that my answer is pretty clear in my mind, but I'm not sure it's a popular answer. I'm not sure it's the answer that many people want to hear. In fact, I know it's not. But nevertheless, you asked my opinion, and I've been following this for quite a few years. I became first very alarmed in 1959, if you can imagine that many years ago. And by 1960, I was on my horse and galloping away, you know, carrying on the crusade. So I've been watching this thing evolve for a long time, and I have come to the conclusion now that the system has been stolen. People are still talking about, you know, save the system, stop them from doing this, and so forth. The system has already been stolen. It was stolen much earlier than most of us realized. In fact, the essential components, the levers of power, were stolen during the Wilson administration, if you can believe that. From that point forward, we've been living in the mirage of the kind of a country that you mentioned a moment ago that we read about in our textbooks in junior high. That government has not existed for a long, long time, and it disappeared when, under the ruse of, we had to fight a war, we had to make the world safe for democracy, we had to get into World War I, then we had to get into World War II, and we got into the Vietnam War and the Korean War, and now we're fighting terrorism. And all of these things are being used to convince the American people that it's not only all right, but that it's necessary to give up their old ways, to give up their freedoms, to give up their constitutional liberties, to give up their system of government as they were taught that it should be, because now we're living in a new age. Well, it all came to pass. And in fact, we are now living in a new world age, and this thing called the New World Order is not something that's going to happen someday. It's already here. It's already here, ladies and gentlemen. It's been gradually being built around us for many, many years. And now a lot of people are waking up, and they're saying, oh, my goodness, here it is, the 10 seconds before the end of the game, and they're saying, how can we turn this thing around? And my message is that we cannot turn it around quickly. We can turn it around if we have the long view of history, but Americans are always looking for short-term answers. How can we turn it around for the next election? That's about the extent of their view. Who are we going to vote for? That's all Americans want to think about. Who are we going to vote for, Republican or Democrat? Which one is going to save us? Or which candidate? Was the guy with the big smile or the guy with the wavy hair? And that's about the depth of their political perception. As long as that condition exists, there is nothing we can do to turn it around because the American people themselves don't even know where they want to turn it around to.
That's a good point. Now, I want to dwell on that.
Yeah, they don't have any idea what it should be. All they know is they don't like what's happening, and so they'll go for whoever's on the white horse and complain the loudest and say, I will change, I will repair, I will restore, and they'll just let those little phrases go by and think that they've got substance, when in reality they have no idea what the basis of freedom really is. So my message is this, that it can be done, and that's the reason I'm still in this fight, but it's going to take longer than most people want to think. It's not going to happen by the next election.
Well, let me ask you this. I look at this and I'm going, okay, what is it that people think that we should do? And they're like, well, we got to save it. Save what?
Exactly.
You know, it's like the Titanic has already hit the iceberg. Heck, it's bumped into a few others. It's about ready to split in half, and we got to save it. And I'm going, you know, I'm just in a rescue boat there trying to save some people, and heck, I'll key the ship as it goes down. This ship of state needs to be sunk. Gone, later, hasta, I'm done. You know, I don't see, there's no, what part of it am I supposed to save? And I'm of the opinion that the whole Constitution was a mechanism by Hamilton and friends just to be able to do what they did anyway.
Well, I don't see it that way, but it certainly has become, the Constitution has certainly become an instrument by which it does not serve a barrier anymore. My view is that the real culprit here is the concept of government itself. You see, as long as we keep thinking of this thing that we call the government, and we use that word, the government, what kind of government do we want? We've already lost the debate, because the purpose of government is to govern. Well, wait a minute. Do we want to be governed, or do we want something called a protectorate? You see, the way the country was created, in my view, the way I read the old history there, is that these guys created a protectorate. The purpose of the state was to protect the lives, liberty, and property of its citizens. Nothing more. It wasn't to provide for them. It wasn't to redistribute the wealth. It wasn't to take care of anybody. It wasn't to feed them, to give them education or medical care or housing or food or anything. It was simply to protect them from predators, from invaders, protect their lives, their liberty, and their property. Well, but then they called it a government. Well, the minute you put the word government to this thing called the state, you've lost the battle, because the government will eventually govern you.
Yeah, no, you might as well just call him king. I mean,
yeah.
You know, in fact, that's what Patrick Henry was going on about, you know, telling the state legislature in Virginia not to ratify the Constitution. He's going, look, man, it's just, you got the judicial and executive and legislative. What happens when they line up against rights of the individual and you're a free speech zone in the corner? That's what happens.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, they wanted to make Washington a king, and he said, no way. They want that. Jefferson agreed with them that we had to get rid of nobility. So they made a big stride, I thought. Now, you can find faults with it, I think, but they made a big stride. It was the first time in history that a revolution had been fought, and the winners of the battle chose not to glorify themselves with royalty and become monarchs. I thought that was a huge step in history. And I think we're going to have a chance to rework it again one of these days soon. And the next time around, I hope that we've learned the lesson and we'll create not a government, but a protectorate.
Well, let's talk about that a second. You know, I'm a big, you know, it's declare your independence with Ernest Hancock. I'm a big declare your independence kind of guy. It didn't specify what kind of government. It just gave you the traits of how to recognize good and bad. You know, when you got people that are collectivized in whatever way to protect your rights, well, you know, we can tolerate that. When you got them protecting your life, your liberty, your pursuit of happiness, your property, you know, then, okay, they're good. You know, they're not swarms of men to harass us and eat out our substance kind of thing. Well, okay, we'll let it go. But when they become destructive of those ends, it's your right, it's your duty to alter or abolish. So I'm going, you know, it's a decade later, they come up with this Constitution thing, and I'm wondering, what was so wrong with the Articles of Confederation? It wasn't collective enough? I mean, you never even hear that there were 10 presidents, you know, between the Declaration and the Constitution. I just really, the more I study it, the more I see that there was an effort to collectivize America under one hand so they could tax you. And even Hamilton said, you know, if you don't have the ability to tax, how are we going to sustain a prolonged war? And I'm like, well, that's the best reason for not doing it. You know, so I'm just wondering if we go into this again, and we can talk about the Continental Congress here a little bit, if you like. And, you know, there is a good people that want to fix it. They want to get back to what it was supposed to be. We're going to sit and talk about it and understand that we need to get back to the concept of we govern ourselves, and we don't have this non-protectorate, as you would say it. We got a national government that's threatening to stick things into our bodies. They are going, yes, we are going to protect you by forcing you to take a government elixir that's going to make you feel all better or not. And they don't care because it's all about the money and control and centralization of power. When we get back, we'll talk about more with me and...
There are those that just want to be left alone and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound?
Back here to declare your independence. Me, Ernest Hancock. Yeah, my earphone's starting to get funky. You know, the one thing I wanted to make sure that I asked before I even forget, Mr. Griffin, is that in 1959, how many activists were there concerned about the Federal Reserve? I mean, where did that come from? And all of a sudden, you know, you're interested in that, Pete. Why? Where did that come from, Edward?
Well, in 1959, I can tell you that there were darn few people, if any, who were concerned about the Federal Reserve, including myself in those days. I wasn't aware of the economic side of this puzzle. I was merely concerned with what was happening to our government, its growth, and the diminishing of personal freedoms and so forth. And I could see that our system was moving away from the ideal. That's how I got into it. The Federal Reserve issue and the monetary issue didn't show up on my radar screen till many years later. But of course, then it was very big, and I realized that was, if not the central, at least one of the central driving forces for the whole decay of the system. But today, of course, it's quite different. Everybody can see it because it's affecting their pocketbooks. I think if we still had a relative amount of prosperity, most people wouldn't give a darn. They wouldn't be concerned with the fact that there were politically favored groups ripping them off, as long as they had something left over, you know.
Well, tell me. I mean, you know, this is very interesting to me. What year did you write Creature from Jekyll Island?
Well, that was the first edition was published in 1994.
Okay, and your interest started when? You're saying 59. Well, what were you doing in 59?
Well, it's kind of a boring story behind that, but
I'm all ears, man.
Well, I became interested, I'm going to guess, around 1975 or 80, because I was producing a series of documentary films, and I wanted to do something on the cause of inflation, the true nature of inflation. And, of course, any study of that takes you right to the engine of inflation, which is the Federal Reserve System. And so I did a little research, and I never did produce the documentary film. I got sidetracked onto other projects. But then years later, someone asked me to give a speech on taxes. And I said, well, I don't really know much about taxes that everybody else doesn't know, but I do know something about a hidden tax called inflation. Would you like me to talk about that? And they said yes, and so I did. And it was well received, and the first thing you know, there was a demand for it. I put it on the road, and that encouraged me to do some more research, and then I wrote a book about it. So it sort of crept up on me, but I think it started about 1975, my interest in the monetary side of it.
Well, then you found the importance, and I would imagine other people did too, because, of course, it's a popular book, and people started to see the power of government really came from their ability to, you know, spend. And the Federal Reserve certainly allowed that.
Yeah, and most people interested in those days were interested because of the academic or historical perspective. They just want to know about those things. But most people felt that they didn't care. It didn't affect them. What do they care about all that stuff? Sure, they said, there are powerful people in Washington. Yeah, there are crooks walking around ripping us off. We know that. They just couldn't care until finally the system began to come unraveled. And now they were caught in it. Now they care, you see. And I guess it's kind of human nature.
Well, the one thing that I want to make sure that we understand is there's a revolution coming. It's inevitable. And you have a lot of people that wanted to keep it peaceful, but they are going to have their revolution. And they understand what it's against and what it's for. Now, they may be a minority, but they are vocal and they are informed. And through efforts such as yours and Aaron Russo and Dr. Paul and many others, there has been an awakening because of the internet and the ability to get, this information out on DVDs. Heck, we have triple 11 stackers, duplicators that we can make up to 500 DVDs an hour, which we do on a regular basis. And this getting this information out is a lot different than in 2004 when I'm doing one at a time on Black Box Voting, one of your previous movies, going around to various speaking events. And it's been exponential. And I think we're in a situation now to where they're not going to go back to their couch watching football and drinking beer anymore. They're going to insist on change, especially as it affects their lives and that of their family. And they start to see a slip into the greatest depression. And I'm wondering, what do you think? Is there any way we're not going to have this currency crisis?
No, I don't think there's any way we can avoid it. It'll probably be masked to some extent. Rather than let the American dollar collapse as it is destined to do, they'll probably convert it over to a regional or international currency and then let that one collapse. That way, they won't have to suffer the responsibility for it, to say, well, it's a global thing. But, I'd like to go back to this issue of revolution. It's something that's very much on my mind, Ernie. I think that you're right. A lot of people are getting fed up, and they think there's probably going to be some kind of physical resistance. But I think it's important for people to be very clear on that the difference they should know, the difference between a revolt and a revolution. It's a huge difference. And I'm afraid that what we're headed for would probably be called a revolt and not a revolution. And the difference is significant. A revolt is never successful. Revolutions often are, and the difference is the reason. A revolt is unorganized. It has no leadership, or maybe false leadership, which is something we have to be careful of today. These people are not going to just wait around and wait for the people to get up in arms. They're going to lead it themselves. They're going to send their own false leaders into the foray so that all of these good people who are fed up to their eyeballs and are looking for a dynamic leader are going to get behind possibly the wrong leader and just be led over the cliff. But it's happened many times before in history. But the point is, even without that, a revolt is unorganized. It's just a bunch of people that they've had it. They're not going to take it anymore, as the saying goes. And they go out and they meet the tanks face on, like they did in Tiananmen Square in China, and they're mowed down. Revolts are never successful. Revolutions, however, are led by people with power, people who are already within the government structure, competing groups within the government. The American Revolution, for example, was not a revolt. It was a revolution in the true sense because it was led by 13 governments, all of which had their own militia, their own training, their own officers, their own courts, their own taxation system, their own leaders, their own parliaments. Had the revolution of the United States been led just by a bunch of farmers who were not part of these governmental units, there was not a chance in the world that it would have been successful. And so we look at today, and people say, well, we're going to have a revolution. Well, there's no foundation for a revolution out there, unless the states lead it. If the states would lead a revolution, you'd really have something. But I don't see that happening either. We see a lot of legislators at the state level posturing, you know, standing up and voting for sovereignty bills and so forth, but they would never even come close to standing militarily against the federal government.
I understand what you're saying, and I kind of see it's kind of a chicken-egg thing because, you know, I never see politicians or those in power really as leaders. They're followers. They're going to follow the demands of their constituents or the people. You know, there's going to be people that are going to represent a large enough block of interest that I just want to be left alone. And who's going to help me fight for being left alone? Which one of y'all is you want to do? Okay, you win. And Dr. Paul was a perfect example of it. You know, he didn't anticipate this. You know, he even counseled against the revolution logo. I mean, I got the most pressure against that early on from the campaign. And the thing was, is that I'm going, you know, you guys don't understand. It's already in the streets. It's already in the minds and the hearts of the people. It's already there.
Well,
it's just a message.
It's true that there's a tremendous revolt building, and I'm just throwing out a word of caution that we must understand the difference because it really doesn't make too much difference how many people throw themselves, you know, at the tanks. I remember the Hungarian revolt. It was very, very powerful in my mind at the time it happened. The people in Hungary just got fed up to this point of revolt against the communist regime, and they just went into the streets and with nothing more than sticks and stones, very few weapons in their hands. They had all been disarmed, of course. But nevertheless, they hauled out all of the dreaded commissars and the secret police agents, and they slaughtered them, and they took over the city of Budapest, and they thought, this is wonderful, we've won. Well, they didn't win. They only won for a few days, and the circle of tanks was formed around the city, and they got starved and had no water, and within a couple of weeks the revolt was crushed. And it happens that way every time.
And you know, and I think we can look forward to something like that again, unless one thing: you don't fight them, you just need to survive them. They'll fall on their own. We'll talk about it when we come back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock. But how are you going to do it? I mean, if you're going to use force or fraud, then you're just like, you know, Chairman Mao. So, you know, let's not go down that road. Let's go. We're talking with Edward Griffin, and you know him from the Creature from Jekyll Island, but there's a lot of other things. Now, your health advocacy, I'm interested in that. A month ago, I had a documentary filmmaker, did a thing on Gerson therapy because I met someone, a friend of mine, that we spent some time at a, well, that's a long story, but he was on death's bed, man, a year ago, and he did this, and man, the boy's cured. So I had him on for the last month. I'll be talking about in a week or so my experience, but I've been juicing for the past month, and it was immediate and dramatic improvement, and it was very interesting. I mean, you know, what is your advocacy as far as health? Because if you don't have your health, I mean, all this is kind of moot.
Well, that's for sure. I've always felt that health and freedom were actually different sides of the same coin. As you just said, what good is your freedom if you're very sickly, and by the same token, what good is your health if you're in a concentration camp? But my view on that is very clear, because I got into the topic back in the early 70s when a good friend of mine in the freedom movement, actually, was also an MD, a doctor in the San Francisco area, that started to use a treatment for cancer that was highly effective. He was saving patients their lives that he never had been able to do before. And, of course, the medical establishment came down on him and forced him to stop using it, or tried to force him to stop using it. Why? Was it because it worked? No, because they hadn't been approved by the FDA. And they got this peculiar thing that unless it's approved by the FDA, why, you just can't use it, no matter what the results are. So anyway, that's how I got started into it, when Dr. John Richardson asked me to help him tell his story. He said, look, he said, I'm a doctor. You're the communicator. You do a film or write a book or something so we can get these guys off my back and we can start saving lives again. So that's where I started down that path, Ernest. And I discovered the particular treatment that we were talking about in those days was Laetril. It's a natural treatment. It comes from nature. It cannot be patented, which is why the pharmaceutical industry is dead against it. They can't make any money on it. And I can prove that, by the way, by the minutes from the Sloan Kettering institution that was investigating the efficacy of Laetril.
Oh, no, you don't got to convince me. No, yeah. I get it.
Some of your listeners may think that was an extreme statement. So
No. We're extreme here, I tell
okay.
you. You know,
Anyway, the board of directors said that, you know, we're not interested in studying Laetril, but if we could study the active component of Laetril that works so we could patent it, then we would be interested in it. So that there, in a nutshell, right from the minutes of the Sloan Kettering board itself. But anyway, to make a long story short, although I was studying the effects of Laetril, which is found in nature, I realized that this was not just the story of Laetril. It was a story of any kind of a cure or treatment for any kind of a disease that cannot be patented, because the industry that controls the medical profession is definitely a money-making industry. And so they lock arms against anything found in nature, and they'll try and use their tremendous political and economic power in Washington to get these compliant politicians to pass laws making it illegal to use things like that.
Okay, I want to bring this up. You're walking into my trap, and before I spring it too much, I want to warn you.
Okay. I'm ready.
you have all of these benefits of, you know, I would think that in the 60s they did the Jetsons, you know, the cartoon living in the future, flying cars. That was supposed to be 1984. I mean, you know, I'm thinking that without this government, we would be a lot healthier. We'd be a lot freer. We'd be a lot happier. Everything that you come up, it's like it's the wrong guys behind the lever of government. There were the wrong guys wearing the ring of power. And I have to, you know, ask you, did it ever occur to you it was the ring? You know, it was this power. It always attracts the bad guys. Get rid of this collectivized power to do good, because it always gets turned into evil because they can.
Well, Ernie, you're not scaring me with that thought at all. In fact, I've been preaching that for years. It's the nature of this thing we call the government. Once you say that the state should have the power to look out for us and take care of us and do positive things for us, once you go beyond the point of saying that, you know, government is there to protect us, okay, that's fine. But once you go beyond that and say, oh, no, not just to protect us, it's protect our lives, liberty, and property, but to take care of us and to tell us what to do, once you step over that line, you've created an unlimited power mechanism.
That line is always stepped over, though.
Well, it's never been clearly defined. See, that's the point. No constitution so far has ever yet clearly defined that line. It needs to be done.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there.
It can be done. It's just never been done yet. And I just say, and I'm in agreement with you, that once that power center of the state gets that way, it becomes a magnet, and it attracts all the predator class of society. And the people who normally would be criminals, otherwise, stealing from people and plundering people and doing all kinds of things of unsavory nature to people that's against the law and against ethics, they gravitate into government, and now they do it legally. And they get paid for it.
Absolutely, man. I'm with you. You know, there's one thing I want to ask you this. There were two books that kind of had two different paths that I thought would be taken during this restructuring of the mind of the people. I mean, you know, because that's what's coming. I mean, there's going to be we're going to have to start thinking a different way, because it's going to be different. I can guarantee that. And one of them was Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand's book, you know, the productive people finally just go on strike and say, I'm not being your slave anymore. And then you had The Unintended Consequences, John Ross's book, where the people actually start this revolt like you're talking about. And I kind of see that there's going to be a combination of the two. And I'm wondering, one, which would be more influential? Is there a third, fourth, fifth one, sixth one, 100th different version? Or is there a dominant one of those that people are just going to, as you're plundering me and you're taking from the people that produce the most so much that they just, you know, I'm not playing anymore. I'm going to go over here and sit on the beach for a while or go to another country or whatever. Or you have people that are actually going to, you know, resist. I'm wondering, you know, which one you think would be the more dominant influence in this country, if either?
Yeah, I think it's the if either part that I'm looking at. I don't see that either of those approaches as being very realistic. I think they're kind of whimsical and they're very dramatic. And to think about them, you know, in Ayn Rand's novel, the productive people just disappear and they go someplace in Colorado. And they live a idyllic life there. Well, that's kind of not realistic as a solution to the problem. I just came back from Yuma, Arizona. I had an engagement there over the
Howard Blitz
weekend.
Howard Blitz is a good friend of mine.
Howard Blitz,
I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were promoting it. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Well, he sponsored this program, and we were talking there. And I said, "Well, how are things in Yuma?" And Howard says, "Well, the people are so complacent here." He says, the economy is still fairly good because it's all government spending here. They've got military everywhere. And he said, and nobody wants to speak up against the government because that's the hand that feeds them. And I thought, uh-oh, there's the pattern that we're heading into. It's not this massive revolt. It's that everybody will be compliant to the hand that feeds them.
This vaccination thing, I'm really... We're working a lot on that here, not because of the vaccine. If somebody wants to put something stupid in name, whatever, that's their problem. It's the force. It's that they would compel people to allow a government elixir to be put in your flesh. I'm going, whoa, man, we're going down the dark side on this one. What's your opinion on that?
I agree totally, And but you've noticed also that in spite of all the information that's out there about the dangers of these vaccines, and the information that shows that they're not effective anyway, even if they weren't dangerous, every time somebody says they've got some vaccine, the Bubis Americanas line up around the block to get it. So that's the part I'm looking at, is that we have a long way to go before we have intelligent resistance. We have resistance, yes, but intelligent resistance? I think that people right now are so brainwashed and so controlled by the media that, yes, they'd be not only allowed to uprise, and they might even be encouraged to uprise because, you know, the would-be masters would like nothing better than an excuse to clamp down with the iron fist.
No, I'm with you on that. We've had that conversation. You know, the thing is my personal opinion has been I've been surprised it was the lines were as short as they were.
Okay. Well, that's a different perspective.
I'm figuring, I'm going to see how many people. We got so many million, this, that, so on. Yeah, we're probably doing okay.
You think we're making progress?
Yeah, I think so. Don't you?
Got a good point there.
You know, it's been, do you have time to stay on for another segment?
Well, you know, I really don't. I've got an appointment coming up here.
It was great having you on. We'll have you on again.
I appreciate that, Ernest.
And I think we'll do that. Ever Griffin from... Oh, a lot of things. A great American. That's what he is. He's really focused on what the core problem is and trying to find a solution. And I'll tell you what it is. It's us. Thank you, Edward, for coming on.
Okay,
we'll have you
me.
On again soon. Now, we'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock from Phoenix, Arizona, in just a little bit.